This week on Behind the Lens, New Orleans' tourism economy is on hold. The convention center is being used as a makeshift hospital, but that's not stopping center management from pursuing a controversial new hotel development. We'll get a sense of the economic damage from COVID-19. The pandemic also has put graduation on hold for high school seniors. What options do they have? And we'll hear about concerns in Cancer Alley about the pandemic. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, brought to you by Community Support. Learn more at thelensnola.org/donate. A warm welcome to our listeners on WAMFLP 90.3 FM and 102.3 FM WHIV LP New Orleans. Right now, the New Orleans Convention Center is being used to house patients recovering from coronavirus, but the facilities management is already looking ahead. Michael Isaac Stein has that report.
Yeah, so we're talking about three developments here, and we talk about them together because they're all fairly interconnected with each other, but they involve a new hotel worth $675 million. A $558 million capital plan, as well as a so-called entertainment district. So that would create new restaurants and bars and venues that would surround this new hotel. And they're basically trying to do this all on a tract of undeveloped vacant land on the upriver side of the convention center. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, over $1 billion. We still don't know what the cost of the entertainment district here is going to be, but that would add even more to it. And so when the coronavirus crisis, you know, really started, you know, affecting everyday life in the way it is now, you know, we had assumed, you know, that this may have been put on pause. So this is something we had been looking at for months before the coronavirus had been investigating kind of the financial, you know, specifics of this. But again, we figured that, you know, this would be put on hold. But over the past 2 weeks, there have been two meetings of the board of the convention center. And at both, the general manager of the convention center, Michael Sawaya, you know, basically said that nothing is on pause. Certain board members were asking, you know, well, you know, we have no idea, you know, what the city is going to look like when we get out on the other side of this. We don't know what the tourism industry is going to look like. You know, should we be pressing pause here? But again, through those two meetings, Mrs. Sawaya was pretty consistent that they're rolling forward with this.
There was some serious misgivings about this project before the outbreak even began, right?
Yeah. And you know, that is, again, what we had been reporting on, you know, prior to the crisis. But, you know, to really get an idea of why some people are concerned, you know, the first thing that's important to know is that when they put out a request for proposals on the hotel in 2018, they only actually received one proposal. And so the faults in the proposal, you know, some people point to the fact that, you know, the convention center never really had a choice, you know, in who they were going to pick and which proposal they were going to go with, since they only received one. Now, the main concern, the chief concern for council members and current and former board members of the convention center, the main concern was on basically, you know, whose pockets are going to get filled by this. And, you know, the answer is, it appears that for the next 35 to 40 years, every cent of excess revenue that this hotel makes will go back to the developers. These are just going to be debt payments that the hotel has to make back to the developers. And over 40 years, if the payments are made on time, that's going to add up to over $3 billion. If the payments aren't made on time, then you're going to see that number climb even more. And there are also concerns about whether the hotel will be able to generate enough revenue to make those debt payments, which, like I mentioned, would mean that the debt would get larger and larger, and the developers would be collecting more and more over a longer period of time. So those were some of the central concerns. But, you know, there are others that really seem amplified now that we're in the midst of this coronavirus crisis, right? So, you know, I think one of the central critiques of this was, you know, if you look at what the convention center's role is in the tourism economy of New Orleans, the idea has always been that the convention center can attract, you know, convention goers who would then go out and stay in our hotels and fill up our restaurants and go to our bars, museums, and everything else. Now, you know, if they're building a new hotel along with new restaurants and bars right next to the convention center, you know, the question is, are you just isolating the convention center goers into this newly created, you know, business corridor that they're trying to create? And is that going to siphon business away from existing hotels and restaurants, which we know are in a really bad spot right now?
Gotcha. And briefly, Michael, I do want to mention you had reported earlier in the week about several groups calling on the convention center to use some of their cash reserves to support out-of-work hospitality workers. Tell me about that briefly, please.
Yeah, there's a group of 21 unions, advocates, and other community groups that are calling for the convention center to release $100 million of its more than $200 million in cash reserves that it has to set up a relief fund for hospitality workers. You know, not just in the short term, but I think there's an idea of kind of a more permanent support fund for hospitality workers.
Mike, thanks very much and stay safe. Michael Isaacstein reporting for The Lens.
Thanks, Tom.
Schools across Louisiana will remain closed through at least the end of April. But what about the rest of the school year? Marta Jusen has that. First off, tell me about the governor's latest announcement on schools.
Yeah, so late this week, we learned that the school year would be, or schools would be closed for at least two more weeks through April 30th. And that's, you know, follows the advice of both the President of the United States and goes alongside the governor's stay-at-home order for everybody.
There's a fair bit of discussion about whether whether the rest of the school year should be simply canceled outright. What do you hear on that front?
Yeah, so, you know, everyone kind of acknowledges that even if schools were back on April 30th, that there'd only be three or so weeks left in the school year, and, you know, whether or not that would accomplish, you know, any good if we're still trying to keep people healthy, I think is up in the air for debate. Late on Thursday, the State Department of Education did make an announcement urging school districts to move their education online. And I think that's probably a signal that they are planning to not be holding classes physically, but maybe that they want to get. Right now, only about half of the districts across the state are having online or remote learning. So I think maybe they're trying to get a few more districts to buy into that.
Just in light of all the challenges that school parents are facing in terms of providing some level of education for their kids, you took a look this week at how parents with special needs children might be able to continue their kids' special education. What did you find?
Yeah, I think all parents right now are probably experiencing challenges and that they are not, you know, first, sixth or ninth grade teachers. And if they have kids at home, they're suddenly helping to navigate through that process. And then when it comes to special education, a lot of those students with special needs are often in a one-on-one setting or might have one-on-one help at some point in the day. And so parents are not only trying to fill the teacher role, but they're trying to fill that auxiliary role as well. I know that a lot of schools are using video conferencing so that students can talk to their counselors or therapists or have speech therapy. But I do think everyone acknowledges that, you know, this is just a really different situation and setup. I talked to a mom of a young boy who said, you know, he's six, like he can't sit at a screen and do self-guided learning. That's not something his age group is doing well.
Yeah. One other item I thought I'd ask you about, Marta, is this call with the school leaders across the state on Wednesday morning with the education department clarifying options that high schools might be able to offer seniors as they approach graduation. Tell me about that. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I think that was definitely one of the biggest questions on the education community's mind because, you know, should the school year not come back together, we can at least catch younger kids up at the beginning of next school year, but seniors are supposed to be up and out of here in May. So the district or the state is providing a range of options for schools to help kids get through the end of the year and meet those goals. Kids can work online. Teachers will be able to decide whether or not they've been able to show proficiency in courses. And a lot of the stuff is normally up to schools, but I think the state just really wanted to make sure that schools understood that they are in charge of this process.
Marta Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There is growing alarm about COVID-19 spreading widely through the prison population. At least 4 prisoners have died at one federal facility in Louisiana, Nick Crastle reports. As we are recording this on Thursday evening, Nick, you have just published online a fresh report on some deaths in one of the federal prisons here in Louisiana. Tell me what you know.
So far at the Federal Correction Center in Oakdale, Louisiana, FCC Oakdale is what it's called, there have been 4 inmate deaths related to coronavirus. 3 of those were yesterday, and one was last Saturday. So the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, just released information on the 4th inmate death.
As far as the circumstances of those deaths, were those inmates, had they been hospitalized for coronavirus type symptoms?
Yeah, so each of them, yes, had coronavirus symptoms. All of them were tested, I believe, at the hospital or possibly before they got to the hospital, and all of them tested positive. There's been pretty significant transmission in the prison. One of the ways we know that is because the prison has actually stopped testing symptomatic inmates. And they say that is due to this sustained transmission. What that means is that we actually have no idea how many inmates actually have the virus. There are, you know, reports out there that as many as 60 or 70 inmates are quarantined. People I'm talking to are putting that number even higher. But it's hard to say because the Bureau of Prisons won't release those numbers.
And briefly, are they no longer testing and simply presuming everybody there likely has been exposed because of a shortage of test kits?
So the way they put it is to preserve resources. What that means exactly, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, you know, whether or not they simply can't get enough, or whether or not they could, but are choosing to, preserve the tests for other facilities or other people that may have, it may be less certain that they have been exposed.
Okay, copy that. And how many inmates, best to your knowledge, are actually being housed at Oakdale at this time?
There are 3 facilities in the complex. There's 2 main prison buildings, FCI Oakdale 1 and FCI Oakdale 2. And each of those buildings have over 900 inmates. There's also a minimum security camp that houses about 140 inmates. All of the suspected cases, I believe, confined at FCI Oakdale 1 currently. Most of the prisoners I've been in touch with are at the minimum security camp. And there's a real fear that the virus will travel there. There have been guards moving in between FCI Oakdale 1 and the camp. I actually spoke to one of the inmates at the minimum security camp, a man named Anthony Fields, he described to me what the situation is there.
Can you tell me what's going on there?
Oh, it's probably too much to say. It's like a movie going on. Now you have everybody walking around with masks. I mean the staff members walking around with masks. At first, it seemed like it was, I guess, a joke. I had one staff member. I was come out and it was a correctional officer. I was telling some of the guys about what I've seen on the news and things I heard, and I was like, man, it'll be here shortly. This was about 3 weeks ago. And I put down if it's here shortly. And the CO walked back in and got on the intercom and said over the intercom, don't listen to this guy, it's all propaganda. And surely it hit. And, you know, we heard that a CO had tested positive for it. And later on, another one and an inmate. And then we had a death. And now that same CO is walking around with masks and don't want to walk past people. It's crazy. Today, they came in and they finally at least gave us temperature checks. We couldn't get them to do that. I mean, they have us eating bologna sandwiches. Well, now we have warm meals. Before a while, they had us eating bologna sandwiches, turn the phones off, the computers off. Man, it's bad. They're saying practice the 6 foot, what they call a 6 foot rule or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's literally impossible. It's impossible. You have bunk beds, right? From the bunk beds you made, they're in rows and they're like 2, maybe 3 feet apart from each other. And so say you land, you're in the bunk. 2 to 3 feet to your left is 2 more bunks. 2 to 3 feet from your right is 2 more bunks. North and south of you is 2 more bunks. I'm talking about bunk beds. It's impossible.
Jeez.
You have like 130, 140, 150 people in here, and it's like 8 showers. Now, what's going on? They actually fixing, they're working on showers on the other side, but we have what's called a north wing and a south wing. It's because they closed one side down, we're working with 8 showers. 8 showers, like 8 toilets and maybe 8 urinals.
Mm-hmm.
It's wicked.
So you're in the minimum security camp, is that right?
In the camp, yeah.
Yeah. What have you been hearing about what's going on outside? I mean, in the main prisons.
In the 1 and the 2?
Yeah.
We heard good things about the 2. They're saying that it's no cases over there, like none whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And mind you, they don't have actual tests here.
This call is from a federal prison.
But they're checking. They're waiting on people to say, you know, maybe I'm sick or I have a temperature or something like that. But at the 1, man, we're seeing ambulances go over there all day, every day. Like, literally all day, every day. And we heard, whether right or wrong, we heard that it was like 2 or 3 deaths over there. We know that it's certain officers. They had a tent set up, which I think is good. They had like this tent set up, and it was close to the entrance of the federal grounds. And even the officers, when they would come to work, they wouldn't let them go. They would have a limit to where they can drive to. They would pull them over, and we were told that they were tested temperatures. And if the officer or the staff member had a high temperature, they would turn them around and tell them to, I guess, go home and self-quarantine themselves. I appreciate that, you know.
Are you?
They had a few officers and inmates to go to the hospital and a few deaths. Yeah.
Are you worried about it reaching the camp? Or do you think that there, it's possible that anyone at the camp has it now?
I'll tell you this here. We have had a few people that's been sick. Being that we don't have the tests, you know, to really solidify the truth of it, if it is or if it's not the coronavirus, I don't know. But is it possible? Highly so. Because it's been officers that we know have had high temperatures, or that's been around those same officers at the one, and they have to come over here and help. See, here it is. Because they have okay, we have two low security prisons. One is a camp, okay? You have the one, which is the low, the camp, and then the two is another low. The two is for, I think, immigrants, if I'm correct. Well, at the one is where they're catching all of these cases, okay, of high temperatures or corona. Some of the officers that's been coming over here to make meals for the one, they've been around those officers, like 100% guarantee. There's a few of them that came here to help us, and we end up hearing that they were turned around, they had to go back, or they couldn't come back to work the next day because they were sick. And so, to answer that, yes, it's highly possible that someone could be sick. I mean, I've been seeing on the news of people who are saying that people who have confirmed tests, they say that they had headaches or cold sweats, and then I've also heard of other people that said, I felt no symptoms. And I got tested, and yeah, it did come out positive. Mm-hmm. I think it's highly positive.
So are they giving you guys any protective gear, or what are they doing to try and help you prevent yourselves from getting it in the camp?
They are right now. They just gave us these masks, and I'm gonna tell you something funny. About 2 weeks ago, I went over to a friend of mine. He works in landscape, and I asked him for one of the masks they use for when they motorcraft. And I came back with the mask, and I was wearing it. I had one staff member like, "What are you doing?" I said, "Corona is real." And she gave me all of these reasons of why I shouldn't be wearing the mask, and, you know, it don't work, blah, blah, blah. And I said, "I don't want you to think in another way, but I said, on a condom box, it doesn't say that this will protect you from an STD or stop or prevent pregnancy, but it say it will help." I said, "If this right here will just help, it's okay with me. I just want to know that I'm trying to fight it." Well, she laughed it off. Here it is, you know, a week or so later, and she has one on. Well, staff members got some, and a bunch of guys here complained about them, and they have brought us masks. And as of today, they told us that they were every day at 4:00 they would give us a new mask. They said you can't wear it if you want to. If you don't want to, you don't have to. But after that, yes, they are. We've been asking for chemicals or something to clean better. We get some type of chemical. I can't remember what it is, but it's just something. It's not like bleach or nothing. They can't give us that. No alcohol.
So another thing that Anthony told me was that there are a number of prisoners in the camp who are older, in their 60s and 70s, along with people who have some pretty serious medical conditions. So what, you know, what he suggested was that these people should be let go, and that they, you know, serve the rest of their time in home confinement, which is something that the Attorney General has actually recommended that the BOP allow vulnerable and low risk inmates to do.
Okay. Nicholas Krastel, reporting for The Lens on the Criminal Justice Beat. Nicholas, please keep us informed on what's going on there in Oakdale and the rest of the justice system.
Yeah, you got it. Thanks, Tom.
Coming up, Jan Moeller on the state's economy amid the pandemic, and Julie Domanski looks at the situation in St. John Parish. You're listening to Behind the Lens.
Hi, I'm Harry Shearer. You're hearing it from everyone these days, stay home and stay safe. Well, I'd like to wind the calendar back just about 14 years. Here in New Orleans, we had a challenge that was truly existential. We were not only gutting our houses down to the studs, we were gutting our lives, if we still had them, down to the studs. We've rebuilt New Orleans one home, one store, one restaurant at a time. We did it. What we're asked to do now is child's play by comparison. We're gutting our social lives down to the studs temporarily. As in the days after the flood, we're depending on each other to keep the city and ourselves afloat. But for most of us, all we really need to do to slow down and eventually stop this pandemic is simply stay home and stay safe. There's plenty of time to gather, work, parade, and party when this thing is over. The more we self-isolate now, the sooner that day will come. Thanks.
I'm Karen Gadbois, founder and director at The Lens. We're committed to covering the COVID-19 crisis here in South Louisiana. The business of journalism is important and crucial, and all our staff is working hard to bring you accurate and vital reporting. But we can't do this work without your continued support for nonprofit news. Learn about ways you can help us keep the lights on at our website, thelensnola.org/donate. And remember, stay home, stay informed. We thank you.
I'm Tom Wright with Behind the Lens on your podcast app and broadcasting on WHIV 102.3 FM New Orleans, as well as WAMF 90.3 FM New Orleans. Some of the unemployment figures reported this week truly are shocking. The nation lost at least 701,000 jobs in March, just one huge repercussion from the COVID-19 pandemic. I spoke Thursday with Jan Moeller with the Louisiana Budget Project. Jan, I'm just going to work off basically the two primary factors that y'all look at the project. Y'all monitor and report on state government spending and how it affects Louisiana's low to moderate income families. Both of these primary factors that your group follows are directly impacted by what's going on with the pandemic. Let's start on the home front. How are you gauging the economic damage that working class families are feeling now? And if it's not too early to tell, what are you seeing?
Well, you know, we're watching the same numbers that everybody else is. And of course, the most startling number is the unemployment figure. More than 72,000 people filed for unemployment. I think that's even more than we saw at the absolute worst of Hurricane Katrina. And we have every reason to expect that it's going to keep getting worse for a little while as people lose their jobs. So the first and biggest concern in this is, you know, what happens to those folks who can't work. And we know that, you know, about half of the households in Louisiana before this pandemic were living, you know, either in poverty or so close to the poverty line that they didn't have enough money to withstand even a small financial emergency, you know, a $400 bill that was unexpected that they couldn't pay. So we know that things weren't very good before the pandemic, and things have gotten a lot worse for a lot of people. Not just in Louisiana, but around the country, but I think Louisiana especially so because of the way our economy is constructed around the tourism industry, particularly in New Orleans, not to mention oil and gas down in the oil patch, which has also taken a hit separate from the tourism industry.
A really big hit, in fact, now. And we know from painful experience that it's often the poorest of us that are hurt the worst in times of any natural disaster, whether it's a hurricane you can see coming or a virus you might not. There's certainly a lot of lifelines being tossed from Washington right now, and certainly the most, perhaps the most noteworthy, maybe these federal stimulus checks that we're hearing about coming to families within the next 3 weeks, or at least some of us. But, you know, these are short time boons for families, aren't they?
Well, some of it is short term and some of it is medium term. And I have to say, Washington has done a pretty good job so far. You know, you remember in the last recession, it was very controversial on Capitol Hill, the idea that government should stimulate the economy during a deep recession. There wasn't a single Republican in the House or Senate who voted for the stimulus bill, which was, you know, one third the size of the stimulus bill that just passed last week. So the fact that, you know, both chambers of Congress acted quickly to pass a historic stimulus is a good thing. And you, Tom, there are two big parts to this when it comes to individual people. There is the $1,200 checks with an extra $500 per child that are going to be coming in our mailboxes or via direct deposit in the next few weeks. The other big part of that is the big boost to unemployment benefits. And that's going to last a little longer. That's going to last at least through July and possibly till the end of the year. Louisiana, before this crisis, had arguably the least effective unemployment insurance system in the country. The average check, weekly check for somebody who was unemployed was a little over $220, which is a fraction of what you get in other states. What this federal law is going to do is add $600 on top of that for anybody who's unemployed. So a lot of people are going to be getting $800, $850 a week in unemployment benefits. And so a lot of folks are going to have the ability, you know, it's not going to make anybody rich, but if you did lose your job because of this pandemic and you're able to get that claim filed, you're going to be able to get some money to maybe pay the rent and keep food in your stomach and gas in your car.
Right. Yeah, it seems remarkable at this point that you know, the U.S. economy and any prosperity that we might have been seeing before this pandemic began was really, it really seemed to be driven by consumer spending in a lot of ways. Now, clearly, if you're going to weather this crisis economically, you've got to be able to maintain some of the consumers' ability to actually spend, you know, not just for their basic living needs, but also for the good of the broader economy.
That's absolutely right. I mean, two-thirds of our economy is consumer spending, and the fastest way to stimulate the economy is to get cash into the pockets of people who need it and are going to spend it right away. And that's what Washington did. And I think that's going to ultimately help. I don't think it's going to be enough to overcome the severe recession we're heading into. But once the immediate public health danger passes, hopefully people are going to be able to go out and resume their lives, and people aren't going to be, you know, thrown out of their homes or maybe, God forbid, not have enough to eat during this emergency, because those are some of the things you fear initially when you think about the number of people losing their jobs and the fact that those job losses are concentrated in professions and occupations that are typically low paid. You know, those are a lot of, you know, middle and upper income people are able to work at home, and you know, their lives have been inconvenienced, but they're still drawing a paycheck, and they have the ability to adjust. It's the folks who are working at cash registers or tending bar, waiting tables, you know, carrying luggage in a hotel. Those are the folks who can't work and can't take their jobs home with them, and really need help right away.
Let's shift to state spending, Jan. Of course, that spending depends on revenue. Revenue depends on, in greatest part, on the state economy. So what kind of indicators are you keeping an eye on right now as this crisis unfolds in terms of how the state is doing overall?
That's a great question. The first thing to understand is, you know, when recessions strike, any kind of recession, two things happen. Number one, the demand for state services goes up. People need more health care. They need more state services provided. And the revenue to pay for those services goes down. So state governments have to balance their budget. You can only spend what you take in, unlike the federal government. In Louisiana, about two-thirds of our budget comes from sales taxes and individual income taxes. We get another 8% or so from gambling proceeds, and then we get about 6% of the budget comes from oil and gas. So you're looking at, obviously, sales taxes are going to be way down. We don't have the exact number. When people lose their jobs, they stop earning income, and so those collections are going to be way down. We know the gambling industry has ground to a complete halt. And we know oil and gas revenues are going to be down severely because of the drop in the price of oil. So we're going to see some preliminary numbers from the Revenue Estimating Conference on April 8th, a week from today. And we don't know what those numbers are going to look like, but we know it's going to be pretty awful. And so when the legislature comes back, which now looks like it's going to be in May, they're going to have two big things on their plate. The first thing they're going to have to do is adjust the current year budget. You know, we're in a budget cycle right now that ends on June 30th. And the revenue projections from this year are going to have to be adjusted downwards. And so they're going to have to pass the budget, possibly make some mid-year cuts. And then the other job they have is to pass the budget for next year, the fiscal year that starts after July 1st. And that in some ways is going to be even more difficult, because then you're going to have to try to project how long you think this recession is going to last, how deep it's going to be, and how it's going to affect state revenues. That's an incredibly difficult job at this point, because we just don't know how long this isolation is going to last, how many businesses are going to be able to reopen, and most importantly, how much aid we're going to get from the federal government. We know that the stimulus bill included some money that goes directly to state governments. The number that I've seen is $1.8 billion. That's going to be a big help, but it's not going to be enough. But we also know that Congress is looking at making additional stimulus bills sometime later this spring. So this is not the end of the story. There's actually going to be more stimulus coming from Congress. And I think the first order of business is going to be helping state governments, because Louisiana is not the only one facing these downfalls, shortfalls. Every single state is going through this.
Right. As helpful as that federal funding after Katrina was, it was going primarily to just a handful of states, including Louisiana. Now you're looking at perhaps as many as 50 states plus territories looking for huge need for support from the federal government.
Yeah. And Tom, I think one thing I want to add, you know, one thing that makes this disaster so different from other disasters, you know, Louisiana, of course, has been through more disasters than almost any other state. We're kind of used to dealing with this. But when Katrina came, you remember, our economy was devastated. But then we had a big boom after that. And that was partly because of all the federal money, but it was also because of all the economic activity that you get after a disaster. People have to replace their cars. They have to rebuild their homes. You had to rebuild a lot of public infrastructure. So there was a lot of jobs and spending associated with that. This is a different type of disaster. When this is over and the governor tells us we can go back to leading our lives, we're not going to rebuild our houses. We're going to go out to dinner and maybe go to the mall and buy a pair of pants. So we're not going to have the same economic stimulus that we saw after Katrina and after other disasters. You know, we're watching very closely the unemployment numbers and how the State Workforce Commission, which administers the unemployment system, how quickly they can ramp up to process all these claims. You know, if you're used to processing 1,000 claims a week, and all of a sudden you have 70 times that amount coming in, that just puts a big burden on the agency. There's money in one of the stimulus bills to help the state cope with that. But we hope that the state, you know, gets that ramped up quickly so that they can process all the claims that are going to come in so that everybody can get the benefits that are due to them. That's probably the biggest thing we're watching. On the bright side, I will say, you know, we talked about the increased demand on state resources. Louisiana expanded Medicaid in 2016, and I thought it was a smart thing to do long before this pandemic. But the fact that, you know, all these people who are unemployed are going to be able to get health coverage through Medicaid and therefore be able to, you know, if they do get sick, they are not going to end up with a pile of bills that they'll be unable to pay because the Medicaid system is there for it. That's going to put, again, a strain on the state budget, but that's better than sending a bunch of bills to low-income people who lost their jobs and all of a sudden have health care bills that they just can't pay. So we should all be grateful that the Medicaid program is there. We should be grateful that Congress frankly stepped up to the plate to improve the unemployment system, but we should also understand that there is a lot more work to be done, and obviously we're all in uncharted waters here, and I think it's going to take a long time to dig out from this.
Properly said, and Jan, we'll take every silver lining we can find, my friend.
Absolutely. I just wanted to thank everybody at the Lens, you, Tom, and everybody there. You know, journalism and good information is never more important than a time like this. You know, there's a lot more eyeballs on the news these days, and you guys are doing a great job.
Really appreciate that kindness, Jan, and we'll keep up our work and hope to be able to take advantage of your insights and wisdom as this unfolds. Jan Mueller with the Louisiana Budget Project. Really appreciate you.
Anytime, Tom.
As more and more cases of COVID-19 are reported, it's clear that communities outside the cities remain extremely vulnerable. Most of these communities have far fewer resources to cope with this crisis and less access to them. I spoke with journalist Julie Domanski, who's been talking with people in the state's petrochemical corridor. Initially wanted to bring you in, Julie, because I read your one of your latest reports on DSmog, the news blog on environmental affairs, and you had spoken with Robert Taylor with the Concerned Citizens of St. John the Baptist Parish. Why don't you remind our listeners, and they've heard from Robert Taylor before, but remind our listeners who Robert is.
Oh, well, Robert is a jack of many trades. He's a great musician, and he does construction work. He installs air conditioning and stuff like that. But he's also the head of the Concerned Citizens of St. John the Baptist. He founded the group in late 2016 after the community learned that it wasn't in their imagination that the nearby DuPont plant, which is now owned by Danka, is admitting carcinogens in the air. In late 2016, they learned that that reality had been documented by the EPA, and the group formed and has been fighting to get clean air ever since.
So you spoke with him last week, I believe, early last week. And the context of that interview, of course, the rising or the growing threat of COVID-19, the pandemic we're now all dealing with. Talk about some of what his concerns were at the time that you spoke with him for this.
Well, like a lot of things, things get out to the parishes a little bit later than they get into the city. So people really weren't paying too much attention to the pandemic. It actually was a little more than last week. I think it was the week before. So we're almost going back 2 weeks when I did that last interview. Mm-hmm. And Robert had some awareness, but not enough. And he wasn't alone. People really weren't practicing social distancing much at all. Life was still going on as usual. And by the time Robert had gone to the store to stock up on things, he found to his chagrin that there really wasn't anything to be bought, that the shelves had been wiped out. So that was one of the issues out in that parish that people were facing that we addressed in the interview.
Let's play a little clip from your interview that you posted to YouTube. Robert Taylor, Concerned Citizens of St. John.
From what I'm hearing about the coronavirus, our people are certainly not prepared for it. I mean, you know, we have to be more at risk than the average community just from the fact of what we're suffering from the onslaught of this chemical plant. The diseases, the fact that we have to fight off these chemicals every day. They're releasing 29 chemicals on us. And right now, as we speak, for the last couple of weeks, they've been asking the government to allow them to increase the amount of stuff they're putting on us. They want to dump more poisons into the river. They're actually seeking that. Quietly, the public don't know about it, but they're actually trying to dump more chemicals on us. And then all of a sudden, we're hit with the coronavirus. I don't have any good feelings about how we might even begin to fare under the attack, suffering now from a pandemic. We've been suffering horribly with health issues here. I mean, we're fighting and struggling for our lives already from the man-made epidemic or pandemic or whatever. To me, that's been an issue with us here in this community.
So when I spoke to Robert this morning, he wasn't aware that it had spread so widely in his community, and he was really alarmed. And I think he's going to start staying in a little more than he has. Robert is 80, and it would be a really good idea for him to shelter in place. But, you know, it's not easy for people to change their habits, and there really isn't that much community outreach, as far as I know, because he surely hasn't gotten anywhere. People have really stressed the importance of staying inside.
Right, and we're really starting to see a bit more of what we feared with regard to the sort of more rural communities in our region.
Certainly St. John is in the heart of what we refer to as Cancer Alley or Death Alley in some quarters. It's got a very high level of industrial development in terms of petrochemical plants, chemical facilities. And there have been complaints for a number of years about air quality there. And then on the other hand, it's also more broadly what we are tending to see with rural communities being a little behind the game when compared to more suburban or urban areas, a little less involved in following what's going on, and but unfortunately, still very vulnerable.
Well, yeah, and you know, you have things like Congressman Cedric Richmond had a call in that you could call in to get some information about the money that people are going to be able to get, the one-time payment from the government. But how did he spread the word? I don't know. Robert didn't know about it. He found out at the last minute because some of the people, some of the advocates who have been helping the community let him know. But he wasn't able to call into the call. It was something where it was too sophisticated technologically for him. And that's not his fault. You know, and I'm just wondering if the powers that be take that into account, that their constituents aren't at the same speed, that maybe they haven't downloaded this app or that app, or don't even know what an app is. So are they taking that in consideration, who their actual constituents are and what their level of sophistication is with the messages that they're sharing or trying to share? It's a mess.
Yeah. And certainly it seems the case that if environmental and community advocates such as Robert Taylor are not already adequately observing social distancing and other protective stay-home measures, well, they certainly need to be. But on the other hand, and while this is going on, we have some developments, certainly with the federal EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, that you've been following.
The Inspector General of the EPA reprimanded the EPA for not informing the people of St. John the Baptist Parish about another dangerous chemical other than chloroprene that they're living near, which is ethylene oxide. And the health concerns about that, they're all the kinds of issues that would make you more susceptible to the coronavirus. It's stuff that weakens your lungs and your immune system, being bombarded by emissions all the time. So the people in the areas around the petrochemical plants are already at a health disadvantage from breathing chemicals all the time.
Right, right. It's what we call a comorbidity factor. And again, a lot of the residents there have been complaining about that and the health impacts for years now. Julie Domanski with DeSmog. Julie, thank you so much.
You got it, Tom.
And that's the show for this week. You can find more of our reporting at our website, thelensnola.org. Check out our community coronavirus guide while you're there and learn how you can keep our reporting going at thelensnola.org/donate. We'll leave you with a bit of piano work. New Orleans' own David Torkanowski with a selection from Miles Davis. Our thanks to David and Harry Shearer for sharing a little piece of New Orleans with the world. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting Behind the Lens.